Tackling Obesity in Maine and the U.S. A new report published in the New England Journal of Medicine last month made national news for its startling and sober prediction that by the end of this decade, 2030, half of all Americans will be characterized as obese. The data is different state by state, but the report estimated that every state in the nation would see an obesity rate of at least 35%. Obesity is linked to a number of public health problems and diseases, including diabetes, cardiovascular disease, sleep apnea, and several cancers, so there is significant societal cost. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, why the rise in obesity? How to not only curb that rise, but reverse it? And what is Maine doing to tackle this significant problem? Maine Calling is next, but first, this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. A recent New England Journal of Medicine study predicts that half of all Americans will be obese in the next decade. In Maine, efforts to reduce the prevalence of obesity seem to be helping. Today, we'll discuss the causes, treatments, and trends in obesity. My guests are Dr. Crystal Alvarez. She's a general surgeon with Central Maine Medical Center, who specializes in bariatric surgery. Dr. Peter Amon is a family practice physician who practices obesity medicine with Maine Medical Center. And Tim Cowan is director of data reporting and evaluation for Maine Health. As always, we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about dealing with obesity? Are you wondering about some of the different treatments available? Share your comments and questions by email, a brief email, please, to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling. You can put a comment in today's Facebook post or give us a call. The number 1-800-399-3566. Again, 1-800-399-3566. Thank you all for being here to talk about this really important topic. And Tim, I'm going to start with you because you're the numbers guy in this New England Journal of Medicine report is talking about numbers, almost all half of all Americans obese by 2030. I understand that even though in Maine the numbers are not good, we're not seeing quite the rate of increase as the nation in general. Can you talk about this? Tell us where we stand.
Sure. That is true. We are seeing rates that are statistically similar over the last several years. So when we looked at data from
In Maine
from 2012 to through 2018, our rates have been steady. Around three in every 10 adults have obesity, so hovering around 30%. And the important thing there is that that's kind of, we consider that an intermediate step towards hopefully going against this article and reducing obesity over time.
Sure, and I know that Maine Health started studying this, in this very concentrated and deliberate way about 2010, correct?
Yep.
And the goal at that point is by 2020, a 26% rate, and we have not reached that, have we?
We have not. We have a ways to go. I don't think we're going to reach that in that time frame, but we are hoping that we'll eventually continue it down. And also equally exciting information is that when we look at our youth rates, they're also been stable in the last 4 or 5 years.
Okay,
so we haven't seen changes.
We'll talk about some of the reasons for that in just a minute. But Crystal, I want to go to you and help us with some basic definitions. What's the difference between overweight, obese, and morbid obesity? And I know it has to do with BMI, and I know BMI in it itself is pretty controversial.
Yeah, good question. So we base our degrees of obesity off of the BMI, which is the body mass index, and that is a calculated number based off of our height and our weight. And so we then categorize BMI into underweight, normal weight, overweight, and then different degrees of obesity. So when we talk about morbid obesity, we're looking at patients who are above a BMI of 30 and higher. And then every 5 BMI points is a new category of obesity.
Wait, you said morbid obesity, 30 or higher? I thought it was 35 or higher.
So stage one is 30 to 35. And then when we talk about people who are eligible for bariatric surgery, this is when we start to look at a BMI that is 35 and higher.
All right. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the options available in addition to bariatric surgery? I mean, there a lot of people don't know that in between diet and exercise and surgery, there's a whole group. I'll turn to you for this, Peter. There's a whole group of things that doctors are prescribing now. Talk about those.
Sure. So the problem with treatment for obesity is it's not a simple one-size-fits-all proposition. So there's lots of different treatments, and in and of itself, it's really hard to do this on your own. You know, so the people out there that are trying to lose weight on their own, unfortunately, there's a high rate of failure. So about 90% of people who are just trying to do it on their own, you know, may be able to lose some weight, but oftentimes gain it back and then some. So the more successful people are following some program. And there are, you know, online programs, there are in-person programs, there are medically supervised programs. You know, and the medically supervised program is one of the places that I work at, where we can provide a dietitian, we can provide a social worker, we can provide group visits, we can provide meal replacements, we can provide medications that can be helpful to decrease appetite and help with loss, you know, weight loss. The other thing we see a lot is a lot of the medicines patients are taking can increase our weight. So trying to talk with the other prescribers for these medicines and see if there's other options that could treat a different condition but not cause as much weight gain.
Is this hard for people? Is it hard for people to come to you for obesity and ask for help?
It's terribly hard. You know, when we see people at the clinic, it's not because they've tried this for 10 minutes. It's not because they've tried this for a week or a month or a year. These people have been struggling often for decades. You know, and little by little, they're gaining weight and frustrated because they've tried some things and sometimes have had success, but then the kind of rebound to kind of where they were. So it's a frustrating proposition, but we're hoping to give people some success and giving people the ways to be successful with their weight loss. And really, my goal is to help people improve their health.
Right. So let's talk about some of the causes. You know, over and over again, you know, people say, oh, it's fast food and sugary drinks. And that's part of the problem, but it's not all the problem, is it?
No, not at all. I mean, our diet and our exercise certainly contribute, but there are a lot of other factors that are quite frankly out of people's control that contribute to them suffering from obesity and struggling to lose weight and to get healthier. Some of those things include genetic factors. So, you know, the things our parents have passed on to us and we've inherited. Other things such as environmental factors play a big role. And then there are a lot of hormonal changes within our bodies that make us, you know, either responsive or resistant to different weight loss therapies. So it's not just about diet and exercise. There's a lot more to it than that.
All right. I want to get back to you, Tim, and talk about some of the success that Maine has had. You mentioned that the rates of childhood obesity are now, are they plateauing or actually going down?
They're plateauing.
Okay.
So, and that's at all three of the age groups that are monitored over time. So fifth, sixth graders, high schools, and middle school.
And so when we use the word success, it's sort of a mild success, better than it going up. But what do you attribute the success that there has been so far to? Why have we been able to stem the rise of childhood obesity in a way that other states have not?
Well, the Let's Go program, I think, has a big impact on that. So many people know the 5210 message as opposed to Let's Go. But that started 15, 20 years ago as a way to help prevent obesity among children, but also to help provide healthier behaviors, lifestyles. It's importantly done in six different sectors. So it's helping in schools and before and after school programs, in employers' arenas. And I think one of the somewhat unintended benefit is that we've helped adults and parents learn how to provide better foods, the importance of physical activity. So that program in itself, even though it was focused on children, it has been having an impact across the communities. And I think that's then poured out into looking at the community environments. So are there rural areas where they can put in more sidewalks so people can exercise more and provide more access to the healthy behaviors to become an easier choice as opposed to very difficult?
All right. Well, I want to go to an email to start this conversation with the public. And this is an anonymous email, but I think it really speaks to so many people. The emailer writes, "My overeating is definitely a form of self-medication to numb the stress of financial worry, conflict in the world, bearing witness to human tragedies from within my local community to war-torn areas overseas. I try on occasion to bury my head in the sand, but sometimes I can't avoid it. While I have always exercised and eat healthy foods, sometimes opening a bag of cookies is how I survive. So I really appreciate this email, and I think it speaks to so many people. And Crystal and Peter, if you all want to talk about the role stress has in this obesity epidemic.
Sure. So if we think of it simply, you know, stress increases, you know, stress is all around us, and obviously it's our interpretation of our environment kind of that causes stress internally. What we see kind of chemically in our system is that stress increases our stress hormones, the cortisol levels and other levels. And what that does is increase our blood sugars. So it's that fight or flight mechanism that we was useful to us, you know, 1,000 years ago when we were running away from an animal, but less useful now. Because we have increased cortisol levels, increased sugar levels, our insulin levels tend to increase. So when we look at insulin levels for people that are struggling with their weight, it's often very high. The body tends to compensate by becoming less insulin sensitive. So people develop what's called insulin resistance. So they have a lot of insulin around to decrease their sugars. And in doing so, the role of insulin, whether we give it as a shot for people with diabetes or when we make it ourselves in our pancreas, is to decrease our sugars. Unfortunately, it decreases the sugars by storing them. So it stores our sugar as fat. That increases our weight. And then when our sugars drop, we get hungry again. So it's this chronic kind of circle that people fall into, chronic stress, increased stress hormones, increased sugars, increased insulin, and people end up gaining weight. So our goal is to stop that chronic stress circle wherever we can to intervene.
And what is your advice to your patients? How do you stop that chronic stress circle?
I don't know if we can change people's chronic stress, right? So sometimes, obviously, if someone's looking for housing or shelter or, you know, safety, that's the first thing they need to do. And obviously, weight loss is really secondary. So fundamentally, our goal is to provide them safety and food and shelter. And losing weight is the next step down the line, or maybe three steps down the line. So some of it is trying to find the resources in our community to help people with the basic needs such that they'd be in a better place to be successful with regard to their weight.
All right. In addition to stress, I understand we're learning more and more about the role of sleep in weight loss. And I was wondering if one of you wants to talk about that as well.
Yeah, certainly. Sleep plays a huge role in, you know, our body's equilibrium, and it has huge impacts on those hormonal imbalances that we tend to have, just like stress plays a role too. And so when we talk to patients in the office who are considering bariatric surgery, for example, we try to make sure that they have a support system in place from us to help guide them through those stressful moments, whether that's seeking help from our social worker and finding those things to help them, and also help them work on healthy habits. And that definitely includes good night's sleep, avoiding eating in the middle of the night, and just establishing good habits that are going to be able to be continued on for the long run and help them be successful and decrease their stress.
Many people who are obese, I think, feel overwhelmed by how much weight they feel as though they have to lose. And the research, though, shows that it really is very helpful even if one loses, for example, only 5% of their body weight. Correct,
yeah.
Peter? What happens if somebody only loses 5% of their body weight?
So you're absolutely right. So the good news is, you know, if someone weighs 225 pounds and we can tell them that losing 10% or even 5% of their weight, they can have significant improvements in their blood pressure, in their sugar, in their perhaps arthritis pain. So if someone's 225 pounds, 22 pounds is 10%, 12 pounds or 11 pounds is 5%. And that's a pretty reasonable number that people can achieve in a fairly short period of time. So our goal is not to say you need to lose 100 pounds in 6 months. It's can you lose a pound a week? Can you lose 2 pounds a week? And over time, they're going to make big changes and big improvements in their health. More importantly, they're going to feel better.
All right. We'll go to Courtney, who's calling from Auburn. Hi, Courtney. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi, this is Courtney Kennedy calling from Good Shepherd Food Bank in Maine. And this is a huge topic that we talk about every day here at the food bank. And I happen to oversee our nutrition and education program. So I thought I would call in and tell about the wonderful work that we have focused on here at the food bank. We know that people who live in poverty have higher rates of chronic disease, such as obesity and diabetes, and then the adverse effects of obesity, as you've talked about. But we've really focused on ensuring that those that are accessing the emergency food system have the ability to have fresh produce as well as whole grains, lean meats and proteins, and in addition to nutrition education paired with that to ensure that we are helping to set people up for success through the food that they're eating.
Courtney, I'm so glad you called because I know that this is really a big issue in sort of the food bank networks out there because so often you're depending on donations and the donations from the grocery stores are things like cakes and things from the bakery. How are you able to sort of change this and focus on things like produce and lean meats, which are more expensive than baked goods and treats?
Yeah, thank you so much, Jennifer, for asking for that question, because it is very pivotal to the work that we do every day and are engaged in this conversation every day. We have wonderful partners that we work with. So one is starting to inform and work with them to share where we receive our food from, our priorities, and the reason why it's important for us to think about food in a different manner. It's education of our donors to understand that the charitable food system has changed over the last 30 years. What once was an emergency food situation, you might go once or twice to a food pantry, has become the everyday food for hundreds of thousands of Mainers. So our story has changed. Our need to think about somebody holistically in terms of their food intake and how we can help support them through food is very key. You are right. You know, those cakes and cookies generally tend to be less expensive and come in, you know, we receive sometimes a lot of those, but we're making decisions and engaging in conversations around appropriateness of those products. And so we're really fortunate to have a donor base and where we're sourcing our food who are open and understanding to this conversation.
Courtney, thanks so much for calling in. Courtney calling in from the Good Shepherd Food Bank in Auburn. Before we go to a break, Tim, I want to ask you about another program that I know Maine Health is spearheading or at least a part of, and that's the Small Steps. We talked about the Let's Go program, which is aimed at children. Tell us about Small Steps, which is, in my understanding, aimed at adults.
Yeah, it grew out of the successes of the Let's Go program, and I know Peter was involved with developing the Small Steps, but it was really trying to resonate a similar approach, a simple set of messages that can be, patients can remember some basic goals to go for in terms of increasing healthier foods, physical activity. Almost turned to Peter
in terms of some of
the details.
It's January. It's New Year's resolution time. What small steps would you recommend for anyone, whether or not they're characterized as obese?
Right. So as we mentioned before, we're not looking for huge changes in people's behavior or people's diet or people exercise. And it's really the small steps that people can make, small changes that they can be successful with over time that will promote long-term change. So the small steps, you know, the 5-2-1-0 messages that have been around for a while are fairly well known. And Jennifer, do you remember what they are?
Would you like to repeat them? I know that the O is zero sugary drinks.
Right.
So let's see. One hour of exercise.
So five is the 5 or more fruits and vegetables per day.
Okay.
Which all of us should do, certainly kids and probably adults more. 2 is less than 2 hours of screen time, right? So TV time, kind of computer time, phone time for kids. And then 1 is 1 hour of exercise. So kids should be exercising actively 1 hour per day. And then the 0 is sugary drinks, right? So the sugary drinks include soda products, kind of juice products, kind of Gatorade products, things that with added sugar. So that's the simple messages that they created back in the day for the 5-2-1-0 program. You know, and those messages resonate with adults, but not exactly. So the messages that we came up and are on the posters and the kind of recommendations for the adult program is to eat real, right? So avoiding highly processed foods, avoiding fast foods, trying to eat what your grandmother perhaps would have fed you back in the day. Move more, right? So if you're not moving at all, try to do a little bit of exercise. If you're moving some, try to increase it. The goal is 30 minutes most days. Rest up, right? Gets the concept of improved sleep and quality sleep. And then basically drink water. So again, trying to avoid alcohol to excess. Try to avoid coffee drinks, which can have 400 calories, soda products and other things like that.
All right. Well, we're talking about obesity on Maine Calling. If you'd like to join the conversation, our phone number 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet @MaineCalling, or post to our Facebook page. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Freeman Ellis Family Fund, supporting Maine Public Radio, local, national, and international news you can trust. Jane and Frank Bragg of Bangor, proud supporters of the voices of independent and in-depth journalism at Maine Public News. And BCM Environmental and Land Law, announcing a merger with Thomas R. Hanna and Associates. More on their Vermont, New Hampshire, and Maine practice at nhlandlaw.com.
President Trump's border wall threatens a national wildlife refuge in the Rio Grande Valley of Texas that's taken more than 40 years to build.
It's a tragic situation. Fish and Wildlife Service staff have worked on this issue for decades and decades, and it's being torn down in front of our eyes.
Why environmentalists are sounding the alarm. This afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is today from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio. Maine Public Television is now included in the channel lineup of the YouTube TV subscription service. If you have access to the internet, and if you choose to subscribe to YouTube TV, you can take advantage of this whole new way to view and enjoy your favorite Maine Public Television shows. For more information, visit mainepublic.org and choose the television drop-down, and click on Watch Maine Public Television on YouTube TV or with an antenna.
Welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, we are discussing how to prevent and treat obesity. My guests are Dr. Peter Ammon, who's a family doctor with Maine Medical Center, who specializes in obesity medicine. Tim Cowan is director of data reporting and evaluation for Maine Health. And Dr. Crystal Alvarez, bariatric surgeon with Central Maine Medical Center. We invite you to join the conversation at 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post in the comments of today's Maine Calling Facebook post. Before the break, we got a call from somebody at the Good Shepherd Food Bank. And I know, Tim, you wanted to talk about the relationship of Maine Health and other health organizations with organizations like Good Shepherd.
Yeah, it's a really exciting time in Maine. All the major health systems across the state, Maine Health, Central Maine Health, Maine General, Northern Light Health, are all working on food insecurity. And to my knowledge, that all links back to the Good Shepherd Food Bank or local food banks. As Dr. Ammon said, food is medicine. So this is a way of connecting people to providing bags of food, but also connecting them with longer-term resources so that they can maintain that access to healthy foods.
On the line with us now is Dora Mills. She's Senior Vice President of Community Health for Maine Health. Dr. Dora, thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you for having me.
I know you want to talk about the National Diabetes Program. Can you explain the link between obesity and diabetes?
Yes. Well, you know, type 2 diabetes, which is the one that's used to be known as adult onset diabetes, but we see it in children now as well, is very associated with obesity. So we know with the rise in obesity the last 30, 40 years, we've also seen a dramatic rise in diabetes as well, type 2, that is. And so, for instance, we know in Maine that about 12% of adults have diabetes. And then there's this condition called prediabetes, which puts you at very high risk for developing diabetes, but also puts you at risk for the same health complications that diabetes does, like strokes and heart disease. And we know that about 37% of adult Mainers have prediabetes, and so about half of adults in Maine have either diabetes or prediabetes.
What's Maine Health's involvement in the National Diabetes Prevention Program, and how can people sign up to participate?
Yes, well, thank you for asking. Well, I know you, Drs. Ammon and Alvarez, have been indicating that, you know, obesity is a complex disease and needs a lot of options. There's not one size that fits all, as Dr. Ammon said earlier. And so people need different options, everything from small steps to medications, to surgery and the like. So what we've wanted to do at Maine Health is to provide a lot more options. And one of the options that we have rolled out recently across our health system has been the National Diabetes Prevention Program. It is a year-long program. We have about 13 highly trained instructors, also known as coaches, and you meet every week for the first 4 months, and then once a week to once a month to twice a month the rest of the year. So this and lovely group dynamic. I'm taking a class here at our Maine Health corporate headquarters, and it's been a lot of fun. And the goals are modest, as Dr. Amon said. It's about the goals for the National Diabetes Prevention Program are to lose about 5 to 7% of your body weight, to increase your physical activity to about 150 minutes a week, and just to overall eat healthier and exercise more. It's a very well evaluated and successful program for people to achieve those goals. And so if people are interested, they can go to mainehealth.org/prevent diabetes, mainehealth.org/prevent diabetes. And people who the program would be helpful for are those who have prediabetes, those who are overweight or obese, particularly people over 45, anybody with a family history of diabetes, or if they have a history of gestational or pregnancy-related diabetes, or anybody who just wants to be healthier. It's generally not for people with already diagnosed diabetes. But we're very excited to have offered this for free across our health system, which is mostly southern and coastal Maine. So please come join us.
Well, Dora, thanks so much for calling in. Dora Mills, Maine Health Senior Vice President of Community Health. We'll go to Troy, who's calling from Machias. Hi, Troy. Go ahead.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I had a question about, depression medications taking effect on, weight gain. I've had a lot of problems with going on those medications and just constantly gaining weight, no matter how much, I exercise and eat correctly. I just wanted to know if you guys had any advice on that.
Go ahead.
Yeah, so there's lots of medicines that we prescribe as docs and as, nurse practitioners that can increase weight. So typically act centrally. So despite the fact that you're not supposed to eat that cookie or cake or whatever, you can't really fight your urges and people end up overeating. So obviously, as with anything, we try to use the lowest dose possible, use the medicines for the shortest period of time. And part of our role is not only to look at the patients we see, but part of my role with the Let's Go program is to educate the primary care docs to say, hey, there are alternative medicines that might provide the same benefits without the side effects. One of the things we see a lot with the psychiatric patients is some of the antipsychotics can cause significant weight gain, 50 to 100 pounds in 6 months. And there are some studies that show that adding metformin, which is the medicine we use for diabetes, at the same time that doctors or providers are starting those antipsychotics can actually blunt the effect of that increased weight gain. So part of our role is to educate the providers who are prescribing these medicines to either choose alternatives that are less likely to gain weight or medicines that help with weight loss.
All right. So again, complicated. Troy, thank you so much for your call. An email from Jean. Intermittent fasting works. Diets don't. Fasting is built into our genes. It turns on positive chemistry and helped us survive for millennia before agriculture, processed food, and all-day snacking. This is a really important unfolding new sort of part of this whole conversation, isn't it? When we eat, how often we eat, and how long we go between meals. What do you all talk? How do you talk to your patients about what's called intermittent fasting? Also, has some other names as well.
Yeah, just like intermittent fasting, there's a lot of different diets that, people try. And I try to have a conversation with patients about healthy eating habits in general. So maybe not necessarily fasting, but the appropriateness of the timing of your meal, not eating in the middle of the night, avoiding snacking. So structured meals and structured timing to help people with fighting feelings of getting too hungry because they've gone too long and now they're ravenous and then, they go to the kitchen and they overeat. And our dietitian works with patients a lot with that too. So, you know, part of a bariatric surgery program has a lot of diet education to work through what are the keys for diet success, whether that's working with fasting or other things to get a good structure of, you know, for your diet and to avoid having to go through fasting and, you know, and eating moments.
Are you, Peter, telling your patients, try to go 12 hours between when you last eat at night and first eat in the next morning?
So it varies, and people come with all sorts of different ideas and options that may have been working for them or they'd like to inquire. So the best diet that works for people is the diet that people can stick with, right? So people can try the grapefruit diet for 2 weeks or 4 weeks, and it's hard to sustain, you know. Lots of diets restrict. Either you restrict time, you restrict a certain nutrient, you know, low fat, low sugar, low salt, or you kind of eliminate certain foods. The problem, I think, sometimes with intermittent fasting is that if we're starving ourselves for a period of time and have a large meal, in addition to eating the large meal, our insulin levels will spike. And that insulin, as we talked about earlier, kind of stores that food as fat. So we got to be careful. So sometimes eating frequent smaller meals, which kind of fires up the digestive tract multiple times per day, may be beneficial. But again, it's not one-stop shopping, and there are different options that might work for different people.
All right. I want to read a little back and forth that's happening on our – oh, go ahead, just, Tim.
As a participant in the National Diabetes Prevention Program, another participant, I would say it just kind of echoes the one size doesn't fit all. Mm-hmm. The intermittent fasting didn't work for me, but the – you know, so I think explore all the different options and find one that works.
All right. Dave, we have a little bit of a conversation going on our Facebook page that I want to read to you all because I think it's really interesting. David wrote, unfortunately, a well-meaning but disastrous media campaign celebrates and normalizes obesity as if it were a healthy and inevitable body type, which is truly only for a tiny fraction of people with severe endocrine disorders. And even for them, it can or should be treated. And then Cassie, responding to David, wrote, the normalization of obesity is a way to recognize that blaming the person for being obese is unhelpful. Nobody is under any illusion that obesity is healthy, but it is not the obese person's fault. And the more pressure and shame placed on them to lose weight, the harder it becomes and the more disordered they're eating. The truth is, most of us who are overweight or obese are this way because of the economy, societal pressures around body size, negative and shame-based body talk in our families growing up, and even simply how we were fed as babies. It can take a lifetime to dismantle the disordered thinking around food. Thoughts?
Well, it reminds me of the, for many things in health, it's where we grew up, our communities. And so I think, yes, absolutely, in our homes, in our schools, in our neighborhoods. We know the obesity rates are higher in poor income neighborhoods, lower education. So it's very complicated in that way.
All right. Gary on Facebook writes, vegans are the only group to have a healthy average BMI. A whole foods plant-based diet has been shown to prevent and reverse several chronic diseases, including heart disease, our number one killer. Seems like plant-based eating would be the way to go for health. I wonder why it has not been promoted more by health professionals and the government.
And again, I think that's certainly an option for lots of people. We know that vegetarians tend to have, you know, lower BMIs. They tend to have better cholesterol profiles. They probably have lower risks for diabetes. Sometimes cost is a factor. Eating good, nutritious foods for folks can be expensive. Eating the cheaper fast foods is sometimes more accessible for people. And again, sometimes it's personal preference. People want to eat a certain type of food or prefer a certain texture, or they've grown up a certain way and it's really hard to make them go 180 degrees a different way. So again, I talked to a patient this morning. Can he be vegetarian 50% of the time? You know, can he be a vegetarian for lunch and breakfast and have a, you know, meat product for dinner? Or can he be a vegetarian on weekends? So parts of the whole can help. So we don't have to do everything 100% of the time, but moving towards a healthier diet can help us all.
All right. We'll go to Nemo, who's calling from Steuben. Hi, Nemo. Go ahead.
Thank you, Jennifer. Years ago, I weighed 235 pounds. Then I started running. And I got down to 135 pounds, and I ran marathons for 6 or 8 years till I got hit by a car. And now here I am. I'm a recluse, and weight is a constant problem. And I find that when I start eating something that I shouldn't eat, a candy bar with ice cream, I view it as a job. I don't eat one. I have to eat them all to get rid of them and get rid of the temptation.
Nemo, thanks so much for your honest call. And I think you're not alone in that. Crystal, I mean, you're nodding.
Yeah, absolutely. You're not alone. A lot of the people we see in the office talk about those same things. You know, you have a relationship with food. And one thing that we talk about with our patients is that, especially after bariatric surgery, sometimes you feel like you're breaking up with food because you are changing the whole way your diet has been. And this is a very important of your day-to-day life, you know, an important aspect. So the culture around eating and your eating habits has to change, and that's a slow process. So you can't just do it overnight. Little baby steps in terms of how many candy bars you eat or what types of foods you decide to pick up from the grocery store are all very important, and it's small changes that happen over time that will help people to be successful.
And I want to talk to something else Nemo mentioned. Nemo said that he had been hit by a car while running. And I think a big issue for many people in rural Maine, you know, you think Maine is this beautiful state, why can't we all get outdoors, is that it's kind of hard to get outdoors. If you live on a rural route where logging trucks are barreling down at, you know, 55, 60 miles an hour, it's not the safest place to go for a walk in the wintertime. I want to turn to you, Tim. What kind of efforts have there been to make it possible for everyone in Maine and not just people in Portland and Bangor to be able to get out and get moving year-round?
It's a great question. I think it from community to community that it can vary. A lot of our more rural areas have been looking at structural changes. So, for example, up in Norway, they were looking to expand the number of sidewalks so that because they found a lot of children were just being driven to school or riding the bus and then not getting activity. And then they actually expanded and had a walking school bus program, so that there's someone picking them up and then they're walking to school. So that's just one example of how it fit their community. I think they also worked very, very hard to open up the gyms at the high school at off hours so that the older population had a place to safely exercise. That's one county that does not have a YMCA in the entire county. So they were looking for alternatives. I think that, you know, thinking the reality, we have the oldest population in the nation. I think we need to be looking at using existing buildings and infrastructures for safe exercise during the many winter months so that people aren't worried about walking outside where there's ice. Malls is another example where it could be done even outside of Portland. But I think that it's that kind of creative work.
All right. Well, we do have to take another quick break. When we come back, more of your questions and comments about obesity. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Maine Health, a network of hospitals, healthcare providers, and specialists built with your needs at the very center, MaineHealth.org. Evergreen Home Performance, dedicated to helping homeowners qualify for Efficiency Maine Energy Audit and insulation rebates. More at evergreenyourhome.com. And Breakwater Curiosity for Life, offering exceptional day school and after school options for toddlers through eighth grade. Breakwaterlearning.org.
On This Day in Maine's History is brought to you in partnership with the Maine Historical Society.
On January 14, 1730, William Whipple Jr. was born in Kittery. One of the signers of the U.S. Declaration of Independence, Whipple grew up and attended school in Kittery and was tutored under a Harvard-educated family member. His father was a sea captain and his mother's father a well-respected shipbuilder. Whipple captained a merchant vessel after completing school and built a substantial fortune before the age of 30 before going into business with his brothers.
On This Day in Maine's History is made possible through the generous support of Marshall Communications. Happy birthday, Maine.
Next time on City Arts and Lectures, author, entrepreneur, and co-founder of Facebook, Chris Hughes. He'll talk with journalist and writer Courtney E. Martin about his early involvement and eventual departure from Facebook, and why he believes the company needs to be broken up. That's next time on City Arts and Lectures on this public radio station.
That's coming up this afternoon at 2 here on Maine Public Radio.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, Understanding Obesity with Treatments and Supports Are Available. Joining me today, Tim Cowan, Director of Data Reporting and Evaluation for Maine Health. Crystal Alvarez, a bariatric surgeon with Central Maine Medical Center. And Peter Amon. Peter, why am I pronouncing your name wrong?
It's a tough one.
Peter Amon, family physician, focusing on obesity with Maine Medical Center. Join our conversation at 1-800-399-3566. I apologize. We have not talked much about surgery, and I'm wondering how effective people are. How successful are people with bariatric surgery with keeping the weight off once they go through it?
Yeah, great question. Patients are very successful. We have a lot of options to help people with their weight, whether that's diet, exercise, medications, but surgery actually is our strongest tool that we have to help people with obesity, as well as medical problems related to their obesity, whether that's high blood pressure, diabetes, sleep apnea, high cholesterol. And we see that patients are able to get rid of medications that they're taking or decrease the amount of medications that they're taking. And those effects can be long term. They're getting rid of medical problems that they've been dealing with chronically, which you can't really say for some of the other, treatment options out there for obesity. So it's a very, very strong tool.
Who qualifies for bariatric surgery?
So there's a couple different qualifications. It's based off of your body mass index, and it's based off of your medical problems that you have that are related to obesity. So if you're a body mass index or a BMI between 35 and 39.9, and you have medical problems that are related to your weight, then you qualify. If you have a BMI that's 40 or greater, you qualify based on that number alone. And you don't necessarily have to have any medical problems that are related to your obesity in order to qualify.
And people of all ages qualify?
So that can be program specific, what they might have for cutoffs. For example, adolescent programs for bariatric surgery are very specific. So you won't find bariatric surgery programs throughout the whole country at all centers that take care of teens, for example. They might be at more specialized centers. Besides that, adults of, all ages can potentially entertain the idea of bariatric surgery after they've had an informed discussion with the surgeon to determine if that is appropriate for them.
Peter, anything you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, it's interesting. So as a non-surgeon, I'm often talking to patients about the benefits of surgery. And to be honest, that is the strongest treatment for obesity. Fixing someone's anatomy doesn't necessarily change everything. So people still have to learn to eat differently. They have to learn to eat smaller portions. They have to learn to separate their food from their drink. They have to take vitamins lifelong. In the small percentage, we'll have complications. We'll have issues with vomiting or issues with their bowels. People need to be informed about the surgery. However, we know that surgery is very successful and that people can often lose 100 or 150 pounds. The interesting thing about the surgery is we often don't use it soon enough. So we wait until people have a BMI of 50 or 60, and they still lose 150 pounds, but they're still 350 pounds or 400 pounds. So their health has improved, but their BMI does not return back to normal range or even slightly higher than normal range.
And you believe it's underutilized? Far fewer people have the surgery than qualify,
right,
and would benefit from it.
Right. So surgery is probably given to people as a treatment option in less than 1% of people who are eligible for the treatment.
Less than 1%. Why do you think that is?
I think people see it as a drastic option. Most of the time, surgeries are done outpatient or overnight, typically, right? One night or two nights overnight. It's a pretty low-risk procedure, but not without risk. So if people have other underlying diseases, heart disease, et cetera, they're higher risk. We generally don't do surgeries on people who are smoking because of the increased risk with smokers for surgery. But long-term data suggests that surgery can be very effective for people, you know, and can sometimes cure diabetes, can sometimes fix people's sleep apnea, can obviously help them feel better, can help them be more active. So it's a very good treatment for people long-term.
I have an email here from Maya. Why must insurance companies classify obesity drugs as vanity drugs and therefore rarely cover the costs of obesity treatment, which can be costly? Something you face with your patients?
Sure. So interestingly, obesity was only classified as a disease in 2013 by the American Medical Association. So we're talking 6-7 years ago, it was first recognized. So as such, the hope is that over time, we're going to be able to get compensation and have those medications paid for, just like we do for diabetes or heart disease or high blood pressure, because we think that obesity is a medical problem, just like everything else we treat in primary care and specialty care, and it should be supported as such.
All right. We're going to go to Maura calling from Falmouth. Hi, Maura. Go ahead. You're on Maine Calling.
Hi. I am a new health teacher. I'm home with a sick kid today, but I did this unit with my kids on sugar and the prevalence of addictions to sugar and the effect of sugar on dopamine in the brain and, you know, sugar in all its forms, high fructose corn syrup, the added sugar in different foods, and how we can look at ways of reducing that. We also looked at Amy Reichelt's rat studies where dopamine affected the brains of rats, and people who are addicted to sugar would not remember that they had eaten. It would cause low mood, sadness. But I think we need to approach it with that level of education. And for my family, I'm trying to limit our added sugar to 28 grams or less per day. And it's difficult. And to increase our walking to 5,000 steps. But I think we need to promote this kind of easy access information to community centers and libraries and give people this kind of information, how dangerous sugar is, and it's actually an addiction.
Maura, I'm so glad you called, and I'm going to sort of also go to an email from Arilda, who says that she has successfully lost 25 pounds 38 years ago and kept it off. She said, no sugar for 6 weeks. I broke that addiction forever. I was able to break unhealthy eating habits and replace them with healthy habits over 2 months. And she adds, my message to any dieter, don't give up. You can do it. Get support. Have a plan. Stick to it. And think about it as little as possible so you don't have a pity party. So let's talk about sugar.
I think those are some really great comments. I think part of the struggle is that so many of our foods have a high sugar content, and in general, there is a lack of education on our part as providers and also just in the general community on how much sugar is in the foods that we eat, additive sugars in drinks, in processed foods, and kind of like we were talking about earlier, those foods tend to be cheaper, they're easier access. So when you have limited resources in your community or maybe limited funds, you end up grabbing those foods. They don't provide you with a lot of nutrition, and they do tend to make you feel worse, too.
Go ahead, Peter.
Yeah, I mean, one of the simplest things I can talk to patients about is the amount of sugar, for example, in soda. So, you know, a simple can of soda often has 12 teaspoons of sugar. So for people who drink coffee out there, just think of adding 12 teaspoons of sugar to your coffee or 12 teaspoons of sugar to a glass of water. It would be sickly sweet, but because we have accommodated our tastes over time to that sugar, people will eat or drink one or two or more or whatever. I have patients who drink 2 liters of Mountain Dew a day, which is 1,000 calories of basic sugar. One of the messages I tell my patients is if you look at the carbs, the number of carbohydrates on the nutrition label, and divided that by 4, that's how many teaspoons of sugar are in that product. Mm. So you can get an idea of how much sugar is in what you're drinking.
All right. And so even something like a box of pasta has sugar.
Right. Right. It sneaks in sauces. It sneaks in salsas. It sneaks in salad dressing. So a lot of things have added sugar, which don't need to be.
All right. We'll go to Martha calling from Portland. Hi, Martha. Go ahead.
Hi. Thank you. I just wanted to mention Overeat is Anonymous. Oh, my goodness. Sorry. I just wanted to... I'm so sorry. I just wanted to mention Overeaters Anonymous is a great support. Somebody earlier mentioned that he isolated. It's a great way to end isolation, and it's not just for overeaters. It's also for anorexics, binging and purging people. They help you create an eating plan, and it's just a lot of help and hope.
All right, Martha, thanks so much for your call, and thank you for encouragement. And that goes to what you said at the beginning, Peter. People can't do this on their own. It's just people who think they can do it on their own are really just setting themselves up for failure.
Yeah, I mean, I think it takes a village to help with this disease, and Overeaters Anonymous, Weight Watchers, you know, there's taking off pounds sensibly. There's all sorts of programs out there, you know, that can be supportive for patients, both in person and online. For people to achieve success.
A tweet from Andrea. I'm wondering if your experts could speak to the obesity rhetoric and the idea that it has caused harm, increased weight stigma, weight cycling, dangerous weight loss efforts, eating disorder rates dramatically increasing.
Yeah, so, you know, there is a huge stigma around obesity, and it's very unfortunate. We've made huge advances in the last several years to try to educate healthcare providers as well as the general population about obesity and what does that mean, because it really can lead people down a spiral of bad behaviors as they're trying to get to an ideal that's maybe not realistic at all that's been put on them by society. So I think that education is really important to help everyone understand what are the effects of obesity? How does that affect our health? And how can we safely tackle that and reduce stigma and bias associated with it in the community?
So one of the things we focus on when we talk to the primary care offices is treating obesity like any other medical problem. So it's the person with obesity, not the obese patient, right? So the person with diabetes, not the diabetic. So we want to say this is a medical condition that the person has, but it's not who defines them. We also want to make sure that the offices, you know, are weighing patients not in the middle of the hall with people walking by, and it's a private area, and that some people don't want to know what their weight is. So kind of trying to be discreet about that, you know, and trying to make sure they have chairs in the office that accommodate people of larger size and you know, can accommodate people no matter what weight they come in with.
And I would say taking that whole message well beyond the clinical arena, if we can push loud and far the message that obesity is a clinical issue. It's not a characteristic like hair color or eye color.
All right. Well, thank you all so much for being here. The voice you just heard, Tim Cowan, Director of Data Reporting and Evaluation for Maine Health. Dr. Crystal Alvarez, a general surgeon with Central Maine Medical Center, specializing in bariatric surgery. And Dr. Peter Amon, family practice doctor with Maine Medical Center. Lucy Suschek ran the board today. Maine Calling produced by Jonathan Smith and Cindy Hahn. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.